From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Police in Phoenix today are defending their decision to use tear gas to disperse protesters outside President Trump's campaign rally last night. Inside the convention hall, Trump energized his supporters by attacking the press and defending his response to the recent white supremacist rally in Charlottesville.
So I'm condemning the strongest possible terms, egregious display, hatred, bigotry, and violence. Okay, I think you can't do much better, right? Okay, but they didn't want to put this on. They had it on initially, but then when they talked, he didn't say it fast enough. He didn't do it on time. Why did it take a day? He must be a racist.
Well, let's hear from John Kavanaugh, a Republican state senator from Arizona, and he joins us now. And Mr. Kavanaugh, what'd you think of President Trump's speech last night?
Well, I liked it, but I'm a conservative Republican, so that's to be expected. I think the president did what he needed to do. In the face of a lot of criticism from large segments of the media, he needed to shore up his base. And he assured them that we haven't given up on getting rid of Obamacare. We're going to get that wall built. And at the same time, he defended himself against media attacks.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, do you think it's appropriate for the president of the United States to say on national television, because it was carried by mainstream media, that journalists do not love this country?
Well, I wish you wouldn't have said that, but I understand that when you're talking and when you're dealing with a segment of the media that is really quite vicious towards Donald Trump, that it's easy to say something like that.
Hmm. So the president, indeed, you're right, has been receiving a lot of criticism from not just the media, but around the country for his initial response to what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. He did read a partial transcript of those initial remarks last night in Phoenix, but he declined to say, the thing that really triggered a lot of folks, that when he had initially said that many sides were to blame. Was it right for him to not include that? Because that's exactly the thing that people were being critical of.
You know, it seems like you have people on the left that invent microaggressions. And if you don't phrase your condemnations in the correct sequence with the correct amount of emphasis, it suddenly becomes horrible.
Is it a microaggression to equate neo-Nazis with other protesters?
I abhor the Nazis. They probably hurt the conservative cause far more than the left, because people associate them with conservatism when they really aren't conservatives. But by the same token, when I see people on the side of the road, counter-protesters, throwing rocks at them, and the police stand by and do nothing, I abhor those people too. Because as much as I hate Nazis or communists or anarchists, if they're not breaking the law, they have a right under the Constitution to gather. So I also blame those who throw rocks and try to silence them. So both sides were wrong, and President Trump attacked both sides, and the fact that people didn't like the order or the emphasis really seems to be a non-issue and another example of people picking on Trump when they shouldn't.
Hmm. So let's talk for a moment about an issue that's of real intense importance in Arizona, and that's the fact that the president last night hinted that he may pardon former Maricopa County Sheriff Joseph Arpaio. And of course, Sheriff Arpaio was convicted of criminal contempt back in July. How is what the president said last night, saying when he said that the Sheriff Arpaio is going to be just fine, how is that being received in Arizona?
Well, I mean, being received fine for me. Sheriff Arpaio is a friend of mine. He is a man who's had a lifetime career of service in the military and law enforcement. He's done a lot of great things. I think it was a shame he was deprived of a jury trial, where I don't think he would have been found guilty. I know personally Sheriff Arpaio has mixed feelings. One side of him says, I wanted to go through the appeal and get exonerated. I think the other side says, I'd like to have this heavy burden lifted off me and my family. So it's hard to tell.
Arpaio did face years of protest lawsuits from the Latino community and others in Arizona. I mean, if President Trump were to pardon him, could that risk tearing apart Arizona?
Oh, I don't think we're going to get torn apart. I mean, look, President Clinton and President Obama commuted the sentence of FALN terrorists who opened up machine guns in our Congress, and that didn't tear our country apart. So I think giving a pardon for a questionable conviction to an 85-year-old sheriff who's had a lifetime career of serving this country, I don't think that's going to tear anything apart.
Mm. Mr. Kavanaugh, finally, I'm curious. You said that the president did what, in your mind, what he needed to do last night, shoring up support with his base. But at the same time, in the process of doing that, you know, he went out of his way to criticize Congress, to even attack Congress and say, you know, if you don't build this wall, we're going to shut the government down. I'm curious, if the president's going to get anything done, shouldn't he have also maybe spent less time going after, you know, senators, congressmen, and other branches of government in order to get more of his agenda actually accomplished? Did he miss an opportunity there?
I don't think so. I think he's highly frustrated, and I think he needs to I think he believes he's got to move these people. And, you know, I mean, he talks tough sometimes. He does that in foreign affairs, and I think it's had some good effects. You know, he talked tough to our NATO allies, and whoom, suddenly they're giving us $10 billion more in aid to NATO. North Korea seemed to get a little worried and weren't playing the same games that they played with Obama. So sometimes you got to be tough, and I think Trump's the man to do it.
John Kavanaugh is a Republican state senator. He represents Arizona's 23rd district. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, to North Dakota now, where farmers are trying to solve a side effect of the state's bountiful oil and gas production. Every year, hundreds of millions of barrels of salty wastewater, or brine, comes to the Earth's surface during the extraction process. And when that brine comes into contact with farmland, it can render it infertile for decades. North Dakota officials are trying to figure out how best to clean up those toxic spills. Prairie Public Broadcasting's Amy Sisk reports.
Way up in northern North Dakota is an old oil field, active since the 1950s.
Hey there, Clark?
Yeah, I'm Clark.
Nice to meet you. I'm Amy.
Nice to meet you.
I meet Clark Stevens on a gravel road near the small town of Glenburn. Just to the east of us, his wheat fields span for acres and acres. In the middle is a 3-acre patch of barren soil.
We're always farming around areas like this, and every year they continue to grow.
Spread out around us are a handful of pump jacks. Some have been here decades, pulling oil to the Earth's surface. Back then, trucks took brine from nearby wells and dumped it into a pit dug into this field. Sites like these, known as legacy brine pits, were condemned in the 1980s, but they were never cleaned up. And over the years, the brine has seeped deeper into the soil, migrated, and expanded.
Because of the size of these pits and how big they've grown because of the salt contamination, we're talking possibly up to 5 acres or even more on some of these sites.
Cody Vanderbush is the reclamation supervisor for North Dakota's Department of Mineral Resources. He sees an opportunity in this toxic legacy to address ongoing problems with brine spills.
I think these ponds are the worst case scenario in North Dakota, that if we can figure out how to clean up these, we're going to learn a lot about how to clean up spills that have only been there, say, a week versus something that's been there for 50 years.
This spring, lawmakers, prodded by landowners, designated $5 million to research this issue. Ultimately, cleanup of these sites could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, with the bulk of that bill potentially falling to the state. And there are a lot of questions to answer. Number one, how many of these pits exist? The state thinks 120, but doesn't know for sure. Then, were farmers ever compensated? And what cleanup techniques will actually work? One of the people trying to figure this out is Kevin Sedovic. He's a rangeland specialist with the North Dakota State University Extension Service. He walks with me through the barren patch on Clark Stevens' farm.
If nothing, they're just an eyesore.
We stop in an area where it's so salty, not even weeds will grow.
So they basically starved to death of water. And so a plant dies of dehydration.
Sedovic and I crouch down to touch the salt.
So you say this is just table salt here?
Yep. So did you just lick your finger?
That's really salty.
Mm-hmm.
But the salt isn't just sprinkled atop the ground. It has seeped down and is now at least a couple of feet deep, bound to soil particles. Sedovic is searching for a cheap solution to get this area productive once again. not everything he's tried has worked. What's most promising, he says, is gypsum. It's a calcium-based powder that binds to the salt. A good rain draws the calcium and salt deeper into the soil, leaving enough room for the grass's roots to grow.
So here's the grass that's still actually surviving.
Two-thirds of the grasses in this trial are still alive.
We at least created a crop that we could either graze, or we could hay for hay production, or we can provide a wildlife habitat.
The soil is still too salty for crops like wheat, barley, or soybeans. Sedovic says he hopes to address that with more research. And if researchers can come up with better solutions, it will make a big difference for farmers like Clark Stevens.
Anything you can do to get the land productive again, I mean, you know, you want to leave it for the next generation better than you had it.
And finally, right a problem 60 years in the making. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Sisk.
And Amy's story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
And what to make of President Trump's campaign rally in Phoenix last night? He claimed his political movement is about love and appealed for unity.
We all share the same home, the same dreams, and the same hopes for a better future. A wound inflicted upon one member of our community is a wound inflicted upon us all. You saw last night.
But then he took notes from his suit pocket and reread his remarks about Charlottesville, leaving out that in his first response he didn't name hate groups and said that there was bigotry on many sides, tearing into the media while quoting his later responses.
I hit him with neo-Nazi. I hit him with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi, I got them all in there, let's see. But yeah, KKK, we have KKK. I got them all. So they're having a hard time. So what did they say, right? It should have been sooner. He's a racist.
Now, there have been critics. Dan Pfeiffer, a former Obama advisor, said only Trump can see the terrible violence in Charlottesville caused by Nazis and then decide he is the true victim. But conservative radio talk show host Laura Ingraham tweeted, classic Donald Trump, absolutely riveting and hilarious.
Well, let's get the view from our political analysts, Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi there, Paris.
Hello, Magna.
And Karine Jean-Pierre, Democratic strategist. Hello, Karine.
Hi there, Magna.
All right. Well, Karine, let's just start with you, your reaction to the president's speech last night.
Well, it was 77 minutes of woe is me, of complete victimization, and it's the same old Donald Trump. When he's off script, you hear exactly what's coming from his heart. And he seemed detached from reality, extremely volatile. He peddled lies, peddled hate. And really, at the end of the day, Magna, he was essentially speaking to a very small, narrow base, which is unfortunate because, as we all know, he's president for all. But he doesn't seem to want to be a president for all Americans. It's very much the continuous slinging of red meat to that small, small base.
Paris?
Listen, I think what people fail to see is the real purpose of last night's statements about Charlottesville once again by the president. He was pointing out for, I believe, the fifth time that in a public setting, that he has denounced white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK specifically. And he denounced hatred, violence, and bigotry. He did that before this audience, before the world, again, because when you call someone a racist, when you put these personal attacks on someone, it is offensive and it's personal. And I know firsthand what it did to President George W. Bush when Kanye West said President Bush doesn't like black people. Many years later, he was quoted, I was in the room when he said it, how that offended him and personally affected him out of everything that was launched against him in his 8 years of the presidency. So I think it was appropriate for the president to once again tell the world, the American people and his base, how he feels and how we should feel about the incident that happened in Charlottesville.
Well, a couple things, Paris. First of all, presidents are supposed to have really thick skins, and President Bush did not lash out personally the way President Trump has. But I want to ask you, you seem to have a tough morning. You got into a dust-up on CNN over these words from President Trump in his news conference last Tuesday about Charlottesville, the president seeming to defend people who rallied with white supremacists. Let's listen.
You also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. Excuse me. I saw the same pictures
so
as you
Paris,
did.
So, Paris, this morning, you seemed to support the president by citing Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville. You said, I think everyone can say that Heather was a good person. But you know, Heather Heyer wasn't on the side of the white supremacists. And the president was saying there were fine people on both sides. She was not. She was on one side.
I didn't have a tough morning. I think the American people that are listening to the liberal media are having a tough time accepting the fact that this president is not a racist and he's doubling down, tripling down for the fifth time, coming down against neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and hate groups of all sides. This issue of the people that were there, there's a narrative being said that there were only white supremacists there. There were only hateful people there. What the president pointed out was that there were actually some good people there who were not Nazis. Who were not Nazis, who were not KKK. There could have been some good people there who do not want the statue of Robert E. Lee to come down, who are not racist, who are not people who are in the neo-Nazi movement. And there are people who were protesting there who were also good people, like Heather Heyer.
So the notion
that everybody there were a bunch of white supremacists that were hateful people is just factually not true. And I'm about facts. I'm about reason. I'm about logic.
Look, Paris,
and if we're going to have that debate, might as well be factual about
we've
it.
We've been around and around on this. I mean, this rally in Charlottesville had been promoted relentlessly by hate groups. And the people who came responding to that were responding to hate groups. But listen, there are reports today about the well-known black man who was standing behind Donald Trump last night, placed there by Donald Trump's campaign committee. He is a wild conspiracy theorist. He thinks Obama and Oprah are the devil. The New York Times today talked about a dozen black conservative supporters of the president. I know you know them, who are pulling their support or questioning their support, saying he needs to show contrition. Giano Caldwell saying he's not going to be used as a puppet to validate President Trump's views. You have never found, I don't think, a shred of fault with President Trump. We've been working together a long time. Are you a puppet? Giano Caldwell says that people are.
Wow, Robin. I first of all found that terribly offensive, give you a pass. I'm not a puppet. I'm a person who, I just wrote an op-ed in The Hill. I encourage everyone to read it. You can go to my Twitter and find it. And I hope you will read it, Robin. I'm not a puppet. I have morals, integrity, and I would never support someone, any candidate, that I perceive to be a racist. And I think those 12 black Republicans that the New York Times found for their article, I think they were never on the side of being outwardly supportive of President Trump. They've always been on the fence. So she can, the article, the person who wrote it never called me. And you can find those 12, and I can find you 12 more, just like myself, who appreciate the fact that this president is doing many good things for the black community and for this nation, like I pointed out before, under ICE, under this administration, prosecuting the most white supremacists in history. That was President Trump. And that was put out Thursday before Charlottesville. So this administration is not only walking the walk, in my opinion, they're talking the talk.
Okay. Karine, let me turn back to you, because I've been listening carefully to what Paris has been saying. And I just have to ask you about the position that the president finds himself in, because as Paris said, he's having a hard time convincing many Americans that he's not a racist. And we've heard other folks say that last night he was speaking to his base. Is there anything you think that President Trump could do now or should do now that would change the minds of many people, many of his critics, many voters who do think he is a racist?
I think that Donald Trump has had many, many times, many opportunities to show that he's not a racist, to show that he's trying to not be divider in chief, but bring people together. And every time, every time he's given that opportunity, he falls flat. He fails horribly. And we saw that in the Saturday response to Charlottesville. Monday, he got better. I would admit that. And then Tuesday, it was completely off the rails in the Trump Tower. It was pretty unbelievable and scary to watch what he truly believed. Because honestly, if you're talking about denouncing hate, you don't need a teleprompter. And you shouldn't need a teleprompter. And that's exactly what he did. He was off script. He pulled out some notes from the day before, and he just went awry. And last night, he spoke about how much he wasn't a racist. He talked about it for 20 minutes, about how he's not a racist, and this is what he believes, and this is what he says, in the meantime, rewriting history, right? Mm-hmm. Because he forgot to mention the both sides that he said, the many sides, how he tried to compare Robert E. Lee to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson when it came to the monuments. And he did that for 20 minutes. And what did he do right after that? He talked about the potential, the possibility of pardoning Joe Arpaio, who is one of the most notorious racists of our times.
Well, he's someone been who, indicted for or convicted of racial profiling.
Exactly. And with his anti-immigration patrolling. And this is what he says after going on a rant.
Look.
And so.
Well, I was just going to say, I want to bring Paris back in because, Paris, I just have you respond to just in the minute that we have. How does the president go forward attacking members of his party like Republican Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain last night?
The onus is on the Republican Party that are in the House and the Senate. Look, the base wanted Obamacare to be repealed and replaced. The House did it. The Senate did not. They had 7 years to do it. And that, yes, there was some Democrat obstruction in there, but they want the Republicans to lead, have a backbone and lead. The president wants tax reform. We all need tax reform. So it's important for the Republicans to step up and say, we're going to be about doing things for the American people and putting partisanship aside and working to advance, to make America great again in their very own way. They have to do it. The president is acting, he's talking, and he's using the bully pulpit, which is Twitter, and these big rallies to take the message to the American people, and it's a good thing.
Okay. That's Here Now political analyst Paris Dinard, a Republican strategist. And Paris, I point out it was Gianno Caldwell, another Republican political consultant, who used the word puppet, and I thank you for responding to that. And Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here Now.
Search and shopping are coming together to fight search and shopping. Today, Walmart said thousands of its products will be sold on Google Express. That's Google's version of an online shopping mall in an attempt to compete with online retail dominance of Amazon. Now, this is the first time that Walmart will offer its products in the United States on another company's website. But will it be enough to gain ground on Amazon, the king of online retail? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is called Better Off. Hello, Jill.
Hello.
So Google and Walmart, I mean, that's some big, big muscle, but can they fight Amazon?
I don't know, but they've got to do something, right? It's an effort by both of these organizations to challenge, as you said, the dominant e-commerce giant Amazon. Now, you know, think about this. There's a lot to be gained for both of them. Walmart now links into Google, right? And we know that many of the shopping experiences begin with a search, and Google hasn't really cashed in on that. But also, there's another component, which I know we'll get to, which is that you'll also be able to order items through Google's voice-enabled technology. Now, the cool thing from Google's perspective is that they're going to be able to link to your past history of shopping at Walmart. And so now, what's Google going to get? They're going to be able to learn your shopping patterns and maybe recommend suitable products for you. So there's a lot to be gained for both of these organizations.
Right. So, but Amazon has spent years and years and years creating a shopping habit, right, amongst tens, hundreds of millions of people. I mean, can Google Express, you know, change those habits? I think everyone I know right now, when they want to buy something, they don't go to Google first. They just go straight to Amazon.
They may, but, you know, think about this. I was just, like, considering this morning, is that, you know, when you do start a shopping experience, you may go first to Prime or you might go to Amazon, but often you do start with a Google search just to sort of see something. And then, oh, you're like, okay, maybe I'll go to Amazon and buy it there. And I think that this is an opportunity to expand Google Express. You know, you will be able to get a few benefits, but I know it's hard to imagine that they're going to really be able to fight back Amazon. On the other hand, doing nothing only further cements Amazon's dominance. I just want to point out that in July, Amazon snagged 45 cents out of every dollar spent online.
Wow.
Walmart claimed just 2 cents of every dollar. So obviously, they've got to do something or else they're going to lose the online battle.
So I want to ask you another question about voice and how that might change the way we shop. Other than my personal nightmare of my kids is accidentally of like saying Wildcrats and ordering 10, you know, seasons of DVDs on accident, having it show up at my door. But how much is, you know, all this voice-enabled technology going to change how we shop?
You know, I spoke to a couple of retail analysts and investors this morning. And one of the things that, to a person, each one said is that the move has probably more to do with how we will be shopping in the future, and that is by voice. Now, Google itself says that 20% of every smartphone search is conducted by voice. So now we're likely to see that trend evolve into voice purchasing. And yes, it can be kind of scary. On the other hand, if it's going to happen, this is a way into that business. And again, marrying two organizations that have something to learn from one another.
Interesting. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. It is always a pleasure to talk with you, Jill. Thank you so much.
Take care.
People who protested in Phoenix last night are railing against the police there today because of the department's decision to use tear gas on protesters after President Trump's campaign rally. The police response to another rally last weekend in Boston is being praised and questioned. 40,000 people jammed the streets of downtown Boston to protest the 30 or so libertarian and right-wing free speech activists who were escorted out by police after they spoke. Their rally was organized by a 23-year-old to protest what he saw as limits to free speech, for instance, on college campuses. The counter-protesters and city officials claimed victory afterwards, but rally speakers didn't have a permit for a sound system, so no one could hear them. The bandstand they spoke from was separated from the crowd by a 35-yard grass moat and then fencing. The press was not allowed onto the bandstand in the protected area to hear the speakers, and some speakers and people sympathetic to them couldn't get to the bandstand because of the crowd. Police Commissioner Bill Evans responded to a question about that.
I'm not going to listen to people who come in here and want to talk about hate. And you know what? If they didn't get in, it's a good thing because their message isn't what we want to hear.
Let's bring in civil rights litigator Harvey Silverglade. Harvey, the president, the police, the counter-protesters are all, you know, called the event a huge success. You say what?
Well, the event certainly was not a free speech success. Nobody heard the speaker speak, and they apparently didn't even speak. Nobody heard them, so how could that be a free speech success? I think the definition of a success that people are using was nobody was killed. Well, that's a pretty low standard.
Well, they did get to speak, Harvey. The fact is you may not know that because the press weren't up on the bandstand, but they did get to speak. Several speakers spoke, and we know this because they had their own, you know, iPhones and such. They recorded some of it. But the Boston police are quick to say it's not their fault that these organizers didn't know that they should have had a sound system.
Well, the fault is shared by a lot of people. But collectively, they all managed to keep this from being a free speech event. The purpose of it was the group wanted to have their say and to be heard. They were not heard, and that is a collective responsibility.
Well, you know, the response to that has been, why should we hear these people? We know who some of them were. Some of them dropped out, but we know that the speakers included Kyle Chapman. On his Twitter page, he describes himself as an American nationalist. He has the nickname Stickman after being filmed at a pro-Trump march in Berkeley, hitting counter-demonstrators with a stick. Kyle Chapman has charges for holding people up by gunpoint. He's referred to himself as the alt-knight, pledged to fight the left. Joe Biggs, who worked for Alex Jones' InfoWars website, they propagate outright lies, such as the Newtown slaughter of school children was made up to take guns away. Joe Biggs is also behind Pizzagate. That's the lie that Hillary Clinton ran a child sex ring in a pizza restaurant. That lie, and the person behind it, Joe Biggs, provoked a man to go to that pizza parlor with a gun to try to liberate non-existent children. You know, people are saying, why should we allow that person to speak on Boston Common? That is sort of the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater.
I have two responses to that. First of all, the purpose of the event was to hear a variety of points of view. You do not have a variety of points of view when you say, well, this person shouldn't be heard because it's hate speech. This person shouldn't be heard because he's dangerous. That is not free speech when you only hear the people who agree with you, okay? Number two, for our own security, we need to hear the people who we think are dangerous or could be dangerous so that we know whom to watch out for. If you don't allow even dangerous people to speak, how do you know where you have to watch out of the corner of your eye?
Even days after there was such anger at the free speech that was exhibited in Charlottesville that someone was run down and over and killed. I mean, you, as you know, some cities, Austin comes to mind, canceled rallies that were scheduled for this past week by right-wing leaning groups because they knew it would foment that kind of violence. Well, you know, this puts police in a kind of a difficult position.
Well, the Boston has a better reputation than a lot of cities for tolerance, free speech. But if, in fact, that's exaggerated and we have become censorious and intolerant of other people's points of view, this event could have been held in a theater with a limited number of people in the audience where the police could much more easily control for violence. People could have been searched for weapons before going into the theater. And then it could have been broadcast from the theater so that everybody could hear it. The idea of having hundreds of thousands of people converge on the Boston Common turns out not to have been a good plan.
Well, the ACLU agrees with you. Initially, they said that it's understandable that the city sought a physical separation from the different groups. You know, this 35-yard, 200 feet, you know, quite wide distance. But that didn't create a license for leaders and law enforcement to favor certain people or viewpoints, which the First Amendment prohibits. Your thoughts, though, about, you know, the police here openly expressed their thoughts about the speakers. We heard Commissioner Evans saying, I'm glad some of the supporters didn't get through the huge crowd of people because, you know, I don't like what they have to say. Evans' second-in-command, William Gross, was mingling with the counter-protesters. He was asked at one point about the mood of the counter-protesters not wanting to hear it from these speakers. And he said, well, people are, and he used the P word, they're angry. So he understood, again, sympathizing with the counter-protesters and making that clear. Wasn't that a smart move for play devil's advocate here? Who's going to say that you're going to support people who have white nationalist views?
I will respond to your devil's advocacy by pointing out it's not the job of the police to decide whose voice is heard and whose is not. Their job is to make sure that everybody's voice is heard who wants to be heard. Evans, I hope, reexamines what he said, and the next time there's a speech event, he should play a much more neutral, protective role.
Well, of course, people couldn't hear the speakers because there wasn't a sound system. But then there wasn't that other arm of a democracy that becomes the sound system when voices can't be raised, and that's the press. Columbia Journalism Review has written about this. They quote our colleague WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, who was covering the event, who tried to get onto the bandstand. The fact that reporters would not be allowed in that protected area was in very small print in the city's press release. They didn't even know it till they got there. Your thoughts about the press not being allowed?
Well, the press should be making a lot of noise about this. They're wasting an awful lot of space and time and print by criticizing the speakers that they never heard, and they should be criticizing the city that contributed to this vast silence.
Harvey, you keep saying that the voices were not heard, and they were not that day. But we know what they say. We've heard them before. What's the line for you? What is hate speech?
First of all, there is no such thing as hate speech in the constitutional law. People have the same rights if they are going to speak love speak or if they're going to speak hate speech. And it is even more important that they hear the haters so that they know what they're going to say. You say that you know what they were going to say. But what about the other hundreds of thousands? I will give you odds if you did a survey, you would find 0.001% had previously heard or read anything by any of these speakers.
Harvey Silverglade, do you also worry that this is a slippery slope, that a progressive city like Boston might silence the voices that officials have said they don't like? A conservative city might silence or at least not provide amplification through the press for voices they don't like.
The thing about censorship is the worm turns. The people who are in a position of control today, 10 years from now, could very easily find themselves at the other end of the censorship spectrum. When we protect the right of others to speak, we are indirectly protecting our own right to speak, so that when 10 or 20 years later the worm turns, we've established legal protections for everybody.
Harvey Silverglade, the civil rights attorney. Harvey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we reached out to the Boston police. They didn't respond. But as to hate speech, you can't spit a racial or ethnic epithet at someone if it will cause that person to react violently. And Jay Robison just tweeted me, there's no right to a megaphone either if you forgot to bring one. But Harvey's right. Under the First Amendment, you have a right to speech people disagree with, even if it's offensive and hateful. There's a call to amend that. Your thoughts, welcome at hereandnow.org.
President Trump's Palm Beach, Florida country club Mar-a-Lago has taken a financial hit following the recent violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. At least 20 organizations, including the Cleveland Clinic and the American Red Cross, have canceled events at the club in coming months to protest or respond to the president's response to the unrest. But why are nonprofits hosting events at expensive locations like Mar-a-Lago in the first place? Joining us now is Doug White, a nonprofit and philanthropic advisor. He's formerly the head of the Columbia University Nonprofit Management Program. Doug, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, help us understand sort of in a broad sense, what are the costs involved at hosting a fundraiser at a place like Mar-a-Lago?
Well, they're not insignificant, and they do go through a tremendous range. Some organizations will spend upwards of $1 million, and others will spend a couple hundred thousand dollars, some even less than that. But the key thing isn't so much how much it costs them. It's what they raise as a result of being there. An event at a place like Mar-a-Lago or anywhere else is quite expensive relative to fundraising costs in general. Generally speaking, you're going to be paying about 50 cents on the dollar in order to have an event at a place like Mar-a-Lago. One of the age-old discussions in fundraising, it's just not just a question of keeping the costs low. It's also looking at the other end and finding out how much you're making in order to pursue your mission.
Well, I mean, when did this trend of hosting charity events at these high-profile, expensive, fancy locations begin? I mean, is it as old as fundraising itself, or is it a relatively modern phenomenon?
Well, we could go back to 1643 when Harvard had its first fundraiser when they raised 500 pounds. But that probably wasn't at a very fancy restaurant or hotel. We're talking about mostly going into the 60s when charity started to grow up in the sense of really looking at its fundraising potential and how people oftentimes think of charity as social events as well as ways to help a cause. And that's really what drives, I believe anyway, the kinds of events that are being held at Mar-a-Lago and other places.
So how important overall is this particular kind of fundraising for these organizations? Because, of course, there's many different kinds, right? I mean, there are also very wealthy people out there who give directed funds, for example, or grants and say, you know, I specifically want to support X job that you're doing. As you mentioned, these types of charity-based social events are a different thing. But all in all, for a group like, I don't know, like the Red Cross, how important are the socially driven fundraisers?
I don't feel they're as important as those organizations feel. It's driven, in my personal view, a lot by ego and a lot by stature and a lot by saying this is what we do and where we hold our events and the kinds of people we can invite and honor at these kinds of events. A lot of that is a lot of glitter. And so I, too, wonder about the efficacy of putting on these kinds of events in general.
Mm. But perhaps the nonprofit gets some kind of intangible out of it or social capital out of it by having access to these wealthy and influential people, by pulling them into their sphere.
That's correct. And there's no argument from me on that point. It's just that when I weigh the benefits and the negatives, I have to question whether there is as much benefit as many organizations think there is.
Mm. And Doug White, I'm curious because obviously we're having this conversation now because organizations are deciding not to hold their fundraisers at Mar-a-Lago, bringing politics into this question. How much more do nonprofits have to think about that now in this day and age where it seems like almost every decision can be read as political?
I have always thought that the charitable sector was the least political sector that we have. If we look at business and government and charities, the nonprofit sector is or should not be political, and it also should be ethics-based in a way that the other two sectors are not. Now, you've just said that a reason for the pullout is political, and I think that most of the organizations look at the comments that President Trump made after Charlottesville and say, this we cannot abide. I have a problem with the entirety of it because – and I don't think of it in political terms. The reason these guys should not be at a place like Mar-a-Lago is that they're commercially supporting the president of the United States. And that would be true and bad regardless of which party he represented. And the problem is that these charities, good charities led by good people, are drawn to an event like this for – a lot of good reasons, even though I just criticize them, but I get that there's another side to that. In the process of being drawn, they're not taking into account the weighing of values. That is to say, we're going to make X dollars, and therefore we're going to do it. But they don't say, okay, what is it going to cost us, not only in terms of money, but also in terms of who they are in society, what kind of mission they're promoting and that sort of a thing, have to be taken into account when making this kind of a decision. Apparently, these 20 organizations did that kind of a calculus and came up with that decision. But that doesn't mean other charities didn't do that and came up with the decision to stay. Hmm.
Well, Doug White is a nonprofit and philanthropic advisor. He's formerly the head of the Columbia University Nonprofit Management Program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.